Rosby, Mr. Franklin.
Not a reflection on you, Mr. Franklin. Surely they'd be staying if they knew what this case was about.
Good morning.
Good
morning. Please the court. My name is Joseph Franklin, and I represent the appellant, John Franklin. And with me today is Mr. James Shapiro, who represents Mr. Rosby. And today I would like to focus on the materiality issue that we have raised in our joint briefs. And I guess I'd like to start with the United States.
I didn't understand that issue at all, I have to say, that part of your argument. You're saying that maybe you're not saying this, but are you saying that if the person to whom the misrepresentation is made is a dope, and if he was smart, he'd figure out that he'd see through it, that it's not a material misrepresentation, that it's only material to reasonable people?
No, Your Honor. With all due respect, that's precisely not what we're saying.
Well, that's why I'm asking you to see what you...
Right.
What your interpretation is.
As opposed to arguing that if the alleged victim was duped or was a dope or was negligent, okay, what we are arguing is that if the alleged victim of the misrepresentation knew that it was false or had ample information at its disposal.
No, that's the or.
That's
your problem. Of course, if he knew, then there's no misrepresentation. There's nothing. But if he had enough information, that's saying if he were smart, he had all this information, he would have figured out that this was false.
Well,
that's what's so strange, in addition to our understanding of materiality.
Well, I think that what we're saying precisely is that if the information was at the alleged victim's disposal and the alleged victim knowingly and willfully disregarded the information...
What does that mean? He has the information and he disregards it? Doesn't that mean that he knows that the representation is false if he has the information and refuses to look at it?
Yeah, I think that it would mean one of two things. Either he knows or he doesn't care one way or the other.
The problem is failure to distinguish. Your brief consistently says knows or easily could have found out or some variant. Did you ask the judge to give an instruction to the jury that said if the lenders actually knew the truth, then our clients aren't guilty?
Okay. I wasn't trial counsel in this case, but...
I don't care who's trial counsel. The question is, did the defense ask for such an instruction?
As far as I know, the defense did not ask for that type of instruction.
Well, that's the problem, because you obviously don't know this, but this circuit has already considered this very argument about the meaning of materiality. It's in a case called Teamsters Pension Fund against Angelos, where this very defense was made to a fraud case, and it was rejected based on what you call the common law of materiality. And we said actual knowledge, fine. Anything other than actual knowledge, you don't have to defend yourself against an intentional tort. So that's the critical thing that needed to be put to the jury, and if there was no request for a jury instruction on that point, it's very difficult to see where we're going.
Well, first of all, if there's plain error, then there's still an issue, even if the instruction wasn't requested at the trial court level. But furthermore, I think that when you unpack and look at where the materiality instruction came from in this case, it becomes clear that it could not possibly have conveyed to the jury the applicable common law definition of materiality.
Now, even if we look more closely at what the victims of the fraud actually knew or choose to ignore or chose to ignore.
Yes.
Couldn't a jury still find there were material misrepresentations? For instance, what about the scurrying around to get the extra trailers produced when Congress gave notice of an impending audit, or actually, I guess, audits? I mean, wouldn't that show an effort to conceal the facts from Congress?
Well, the government does raise this issue in its response brief about the allegation that Mrs. Franklin and Rosby tried to taint or prevent Congress from conducting audits on a quarterly basis. And Congress was never able to complete, according to the government, a thorough audit of the Monon facility. But that's not true. That's plainly not true based on the record, because everybody who testified at trial, including Mr. Keith Chapman of Congress, agreed that Congress conducted a complete audit of Monon prior to the indictment period, during which they checked and cross-referenced over a month period of time each and every trailer at that facility. So my response to that is that there really was nothing preventing Congress from coming in and conducting whatever kind of extensive, thorough, complete audit that it wanted to conduct. And in fact, it did so.
Then let me ask you one more question in that vein, and that is regarding Anthem and A1 credit. Or AI credit.
I believe it's AI, Your Honor.
Yeah. Wasn't there an effort to verify the premiums through McPherson? And McPherson may have known what was going on, but what evidence is there that Anthem or AI credit knew?
Okay, well, first of all, let's take AI credit first, okay? Prior to the indictment period, we know, based on the record in this case, that AI credit dealt directly with the insurer, okay? And it was in the context of a transaction in which AI credit voluntarily and knowingly allowed Monon to borrow money in excess of its insurance premium obligations. It's in the record that prior to the indictment period, AI Credit knowingly loaned $1.5 million to Monon, recognizing fully that that $1.5 million didn't reflect any sort of an insurance premium obligation.
You mean the overfunding of the 95-96 premium? Is that what you're talking about?
That's correct. Now I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I'm getting to the answer to your question now.
I just wanted to be sure we're on the same page.
That's correct. And your question was about the insurer and McPherson and so forth and dealing with the insurer. Well, AI Credit, prior to the indictment period, went to the insurer and asked the insurer to help it to get this $1.5 million extra dollars to Monon. So that they surely had knowledge and experience with the insurer and in dealing with that, with the insurer and that type of transaction that forms the basis for the indictment. As far as Anthem is concerned, the former CEO of Anthem testified at trial, and he admitted at trial that during the indictment period, Anthem loaned Monon approximately $7.6 million, but it only had documentation for $2.7 million in insurance premium obligations. So that was information that Anthem had available right there. It knew right then that it only had documentation for $2.7 million in premium obligations, and yet it chose voluntarily to go ahead and loan the money. And furthermore, with respect to this idea that Anthem verified the premiums with a Mr. McPherson, what the record actually reflects is that someone at Anthem talked to someone at the insurance company. Okay, and the names of those people I don't remember right now, but they're in the briefs. Those two people didn't show up at trial. They didn't testify.
Are you thinking about Mr. Carroll?
No, Cindy Carroll is a branch
manager. I mean Miss Carroll.
Cindy Carroll was a branch manager at AI Credit who knew about the $1.5
right.
million. But in connection with Anthem verifying with Mr. McPherson, the record shows that Anthem, during the indictment period, didn't verify with Mr. McPherson. It was an Anthem employee who talked to some colleague of Mr. McPherson's at the insurance company. And those individuals didn't testify, so we don't know what information passed between them.
But are you saying Anthem... Are you saying that the victims here actually knew about the defendant's scheme? Is that what you're saying?
Well, with respect to AI Credit, all right, let's call it a quote-unquote scheme. AI Credit participated in precisely that type of scheme in the past before the indictment period, knowingly with Mona. So they had past experience.
Right, they had past experience, but did they know that this was that history was repeating itself here? Or is it just that they should have known?
I have to acknowledge that there's nothing explicit in the record saying that they knew with respect to those particular transactions during the indictment period that the same thing was going on. But they were surely on notice because of their prior transactions with Mona. And in effect, in their prior transactions...
But it's this on notice that you're mm-hmm. questionable. I mean, materiality usually just means it's important. It's not an irrelevant. The representation concerns something that's important. But, of course, if the person receiving the representation, knows it's false, would be important to other people, but it's not important to it, so it disregards it, well, then there's no... It's not material to that person, but apparently they didn't know that this was happening again, or they didn't prove they didn't know.
May I try to answer your question this way? In Mayer v. Spanel International, which is a Seventh Circuit case, and just I believe Judge Easterbrook that you wrote this opinion.
Completely irrelevant.
I understand it's irrelevant, but I'm not trying to make...
Irrelevant? Why do you try to bring it out?
All right. Well, I apologize for that, okay? But in that opinion, all right, what was stated is that an investor cannot close his eyes to a known risk. If the investor possesses sufficient information to call the representation into question, he cannot claim later that he relied on or was deceived by the lie. This is not because he has a duty to investigate lies.
Yeah, but, the Supreme Court said in the Nieder case, reliance was not an element.
Exactly.
Of,
That's the big difference between materiality and reliance. And reliance just isn't part of this claim.
But one of the points I'm trying to make is that you can't have a material misrepresentation if it's incapable of inducing reasonable reliance.
But that's just to say that there's no difference between materiality and reliance, and the Supreme Court, therefore, was wrong in Nieder in saying that reliance isn't required, and we were wrong in Angelos in saying reliance isn't required. I mean, that you're relying on what you call the common law as if Swift against Tyson were still in force and there were a common law. But the common law of fraud has distinguished for hundreds of years between materiality and reliance. I mean, why would that distinction go away now?
Well, there's clearly is a distinction between materiality and reliance, and clearly the government doesn't have to prove actual reliance or causation to get a conviction for mail fraud or wire fraud. But I think the point of our presentation is that if you have an alleged victim that had information that clearly told it that it should question the misrepresentation, or the alleged victim knew that the alleged misrepresentation was false, then it can't be material.
Yes, if he knew it was false, you keep getting back to that. That's not the issue here.
Well,
I said 2 minutes ago they didn't know that history was repeating itself. They should have known, but they didn't know.
Well, if you've got a sophisticated commercial actor who should know...
Yeah, look, it's hopeless, right? This is hopeless. You rely on Nieder. That's your principal case. And Nieder says expressly that reliance is not a part of the mail fraud definition of fraud.
All right, I see my time
Do you have
is,
another issue? Or?
Well, Mr. Shapiro.
That's for Mr.
Shapiro.
Shapiro. Okay,
yes.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Shapiro?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is James Shapiro, and I represent Mr. Thomas Rosby in this appeal. I'd like to discuss with you this morning Issue 7 in our briefs, the one relating to departure methodology that the District Court used in sentencing both Mr. Rosby and Mr. Franklin. As this Court has repeatedly and recently held, starting with the Johnson case, and I don't think this is just a...
Why do you think the District Court used the word departure? You know, one possibility is that he used the word departure because defense counsel had asked him to depart. And if it's defense counsel who introduces the word, one can hardly blame the judge for using the word too.
I completely agree, Your Honor, except that we made our departure argument not only before Booker, but before Blakely as well. Departure methodology was still very much in force in the year 2003.
Yeah, well, look, if you don't like the argument you yourself have made to the judge, then after Booker you come and say, let's throw the word departure out the window and discuss this without using that word. But I gather no such argument was ever made to the judge.
Well, we also made the...
Right. Here's my problem. You have to make a plain error argument in a world in which the judge is responding to an argument made by the defendants using the same language. Makes it awfully hard to see plain error.
Well, Your Honor, in light of this circuit's repeated holdings since Johnson, that departure methodology is obsolete, we've expressly framed our argument in terms of plain error.
One might even call it invited error.
Well, right?
The district judge is responding to your argument.
He was.
Not in a way you liked, but that's what he was doing.
He was, Your Honor, but that was before Johnson was the law. This is a new rule that in the case that's pending on direct appeal. And because Johnson was not the law yet, because a departure methodology had not been announced as obsolete by this court until 6 months after the sentencing in this case, neither we could argue nor the district judge could rule that departure methodology...
Come on. Johnson didn't invent anything. It just said Booker had thrown departure methodology out the window. The instant Booker is decided, you can make the argument you're making now.
One might make the argument now, and this circuit certainly did in the Johnson case, but many other circuits, as Your Honor, I'm sure, is aware, have disagreed with this court's position in Johnson and its progeny and have not agreed that departure methodology is obsolete.
I don't see that that helps you establish plain error. Now you're saying that the district judge's position remains arguable in the federal system to this minute.
Not in this circuit, Your Honor. This is the obsolescence of departure methodology is clearly the law of this circuit. It is not the law of other circuits, and obviously from that, unless Your Honor...
I hate to clue you in on this. There's only one federal law. We may be right in understanding it, we may be wrong in understanding it, but there is not different law in different circuits. What you're now saying is that there is a debate among courts about what that law is.
Precisely.
Which is pretty much to say there's no plain error here.
The judge didn't treat the guidelines as mandatory. Isn't that correct?
No, that's absolutely right. Correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That's absolutely
so
correct.
Once he decides the guidelines are advisory and that he has discretion, therefore, to make departures without regard to the old law limiting departures, what's the difference?
Your Honor, I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, but I'd like to address your question, if I could, without running too much into my precious little rebuttal time. But the difference is that analyzing the issue of Mr. Rosby's diminished capacity and Mr. Franklin's family circumstances in departure terms meant that a much more stringent standard than in 3553A terms. Just the other day...
Why is that? The rigidity of the departure, the limitations on departures, that was part of the mandatory character of the guidelines before Booker. So once the judge realizes they're not mandatory, why would he think that his departure discretion was limited by the guidelines?
Because he expressly analyzed the diminished capacity and family circumstances in departure terms rather than 3553A terms.
But did he say the guidelines preclude my considering family circumstances in deciding whether to grant a departure?
Well, he didn't say that, Your Honor, but it's almost an expressio unius et exclusio alterius argument because he expressly analyzed other factors in 3553A terms, but he expressly analyzed the diminished capacity and family circumstances argument in departure terms.
What did he say about them? What did he say about diminished capacity?
He said, I declined to depart. He said expressly, I declined to depart.
But he knew he was free to depart.
Well, he knew he recognized his discretion, Your Honor. There's
right.
no question about
right.
that. He knew he was free to depart, absolutely.
What's the problem?
Well, the problem is that he analyzed the issue in much more stringent departure terms rather than much less stringent.
We have told the judges they're to first apply the guidelines and then they, you know, do what they want. So isn't that what he did?
No, Your Honor, he did not. He did not, and no fault of the district court's, Your Honor, but he did not follow this court's new rule that was not dictated by precedent, at least according to other circuits, at the time of sentencing. And because the new rule came up, well, this
case... But when the lawyer, I don't know, were you the lawyer at that time?
At sentencing, Your Honor?
Yeah.
I sat in the courtroom, but I was not okay. his
well,
attorney.
Well, then his lawyer, when his lawyer asked the judge to make a downward departure, did he say a downward departure within the structure of the guidelines, or did he say diminished capacity was now an admissible consideration because of Blakely or Booker?
He, to my recollection, Your Honor, he said and argued... guidelines within the, I'm sorry, the diminished capacity and family circumstances within the departure methodology structure, not the 3553A structure. That's my recollection and understanding of the record. And because the district judge analyzed the issue expressly in departure terms, at least the issues of family circumstances and diminished capacity in departure terms, rather than the much less stringent 3553A factors, this court obviously wouldn't be called a Palladino remand. It would probably be called a Johnson remand. This case should be remanded under the Johnson case and its progeny to allow the district court to analyze the diminished capacity and family circumstances arguments and just those arguments, just those issues, Your Honor, in 3553A terms rather than the old departure methodology terms.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Holler?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I think I'd like to first address just a few issues, factual issues in relation to the three victims on materiality, and then turn to the sentencing issues unless the Court has specific questions on other issues.
I have one that I'd like you to start out with because you haven't had an opportunity to respond in their reply brief. The defendant suggests that Anthem and Peterson were actually deceiving Monin rather than the other way around. And the deception, I gather, concerned a fee for Peterson that Monin wouldn't know about. So I'd appreciate it if you would respond to that.
I will respond to that first, Your Honor, and then I'll maybe move to the other two victims. In the case of Anthem, this would be relating to the second of the two premium financings, this would have occurred after the first premium financing had already occurred in March. We're referring now to May 14th. The May 14th premium financing is actually AI credit financing number two. Anthem was owed money. Anthem was owed $1 million on a previous financing. Anthem was demanding payment of that financing. Mr. Franklin went to Mr. Peterson, this is all testimony in the record, and said, we need to get another fake premium financing. We're going to call it an audit premium from AI Credit. They then create all of these bogus documents for AI Credit, get $1 million from AI Credit, and then are going to give that money to Anthem. They have to